This podcast is brought to you by Lannan Foundation and is available at podcast.lannan.org.
I was told that this reading is webcast. I don't know what it means, so be very cautious. Maybe there's a kind of special censorship going on or something. Anyway, I'll start with a short poem called A Flame. God, give us a long winter and quiet music and patient mouth and a little pride before our age ends. Give us astonishment and a flame high, bright. This poem is called Opus Posthumus and it has one non-English word, which is ewig, which means in German eternal, and this is, as I say in the poem, the last word in Gustav Mahler's Song of the Earth. The train stopped in a field. The sudden silence startled even sleep's most ardent partisans. The distant lights of shops or factories glittered in the haze like the yellow eyes of wolves. Businessmen on trips stooped over their computers, totting up the day's losses and gains. The stewardess poured coffee steeped in bitterness. Ewig, ewig, last word, song of the earth. It repeats so often. Remember how we listened to this music, to the promise that we so long to believe. We don't know if we are still in Holland. This may be Belgium now. No matter. An early winter evening and the earth hid beneath thick streaks of dusk. You could sense the presence of a canal's black water, unmoving, stripped of mountain current's joy, and the great amazement of our oceans. Wolves' yellow eyes were quivering with a nervous neon light, but no one feared an Indian attack. The train stopped at that moment when our reason starts to stir, but the soul, its noble yearning, is asleep. We were listening at different time to Schubert, that posthumous quintet where despair declares itself insistently, intently, almost insatiably, renewing its assault on the indifference of the genteel concert hall, ladies in their furs and the reviewers, minor envoys of the major papers. And once out walking, midnight, summer in the country, a strange sound stopped us short, snorting and neighing of unseen horses in a pasture, as though the night laughed happily to itself. What is poetry if we see so little? What is salvation if there is no threat? Posthumous quintet. Only music keeps on growing after death, music and the hair of trees. As if rivers gave ecstatic milk and honey, as if dancers danced in frenzy once again. And yet we are not alone. One day some guitar worn by time will start singing for itself alone. And the train moves at last. The earth rocks underneath its stately weight, and slowly Paris draws close with its golden aura, its gray doubt. This poem is called How High the Moon. Of course, there were the family trips in summer, picnics by a black canal, named earlier for Adolf Hitler, where crabs still lived. On its banks, the pines were gaunt and stunted. Sometimes, rarely, barges holding coal, like charcoal for a Sunday painter, sailed due west. The heat wave changed clothes like an opera star, sky blue, rosy, scarlet, finally white, transparent. My uncle supervised our outings. He loved life, but it wasn't mutual. If anyone had told me then that this was childhood, I would have said no. It was just hours and days, endless hours, the sweet days of June on the banks of a canal that never rushed, drenched in damp dreams, and the meek young moon setting out alone to vanquish night. But I'm not writing only on canals. Sometimes you read two poems in a row and you say, what, am I a canal poet? Not really. So maybe now an ocean poem too. This poem is called Sunrise Over Cassis. And Cassis is a charming town in southern France. In the semi-darkness, white buildings loom, not fully formulated, and beside them, the gray vineyards, the quiet before dawn. Judas counts his silver coins, but olive trees contorted in wild prayer enter the earth ever more deeply. Where is the sun? But it's still cold, and a humble landscape spreads around us. The stars have gone and priests sleep tight. Birds aren't allowed to sing in August, and only now and then one stammers like a lazy boy in high school Latin. It's 5 a.m. and despair lives in so many houses. This is the time when sad philosophers with narrow faces compose their jaded aphorisms and warn conductors who'd brought Bruckner and Mahler back to life that evening drift off to sleep, unwilling, unapplauded, and whores go home to their shabby apartments. We ask that the vineyards, gray as if coated with volcanic ash, be given life, and that the great distant cities awaken from their apathy. And I ask not to confuse freedom with chaos, and to regain the faith that unites things seen and unseen, but doesn't lull the heart. Beneath us, the sea turns blue, and the horizon's line grows ever finer, like a slender fillet that embraces lovingly and firmly our turning planet. And we see fishing boats rock trustfully like gulls upon the deep blue waters. And a moment later, the sun's crimson disk emerges from a half circle of hills and returns the gift of light. I should have said, but it's not too late, that the translation of this poem is by Claire Kavanagh. So because I'm writing Polish, and then my friend Claire Kavanagh. But now is doing the translation. I will read now an older poem, which was translated by Renata Gorczynski. This one is called Late Beethoven and has an epigraph from Confucius, who said, I haven't yet known a man who loved virtue as strongly as one loves beauty. Nobody knows who she was, the immortal beloved. Apart from that, everything is clear. Feathery notes rest peacefully on the threads of the staff, like martins just come from the Atlantic. What would I have to be in order to speak about him, he who is still growing? Now we are walking alone, without ghosts or banners. Long live chaos, say our solitary mouth. We know that he dressed carelessly, that he was given to fits of avarice, that he wasn't always fair to his friends. Friends are 100 years late with their impeccable smiles. Who was the immortal beloved? Certainly he loved virtue more than beauty, but the nameless god of beauty dwelt in him and compelled his obedience. He improvised for hours. A few minutes of each improvisation were noted down. These minutes belong neither to the 19th nor to the 20th century. As if hydrochloric acid burned a window in velvet, thus opening a passage to even smoother velvet, thin as a spider web. Now they name ships and perfumes after him. They don't know who the immortal beloved was, otherwise new cities and pâtés would bear her name. But it's useless. Only velvet growing under velvet, like a leaf hidden safely in another leaf, light in darkness. Unending adagios, that's how tired freedom breathes. Biographers argue only over details, why he tormented his nephew Carl so much, why he walked so fast, why he didn't go to London. Apart from that, everything is clear. We don't know what music is, who speaks in it, to whom it is addressed, why it is so obstinately silent, why it circles and returns instead of giving a straight answer as the gospel demands. Prophecies were not fulfilled. The Chinese didn't reach the Rhine. Once more, it turned out that the real world doesn't exist, to the immense relief of antiquaries. The secret was hidden somewhere else, not in soldiers' knapsacks, but in a few notebooks. Grill Parzer, he, Chopin. Generals are cast in lead and in tinsel to give hell's flame a moment of respite after kilowatts of straw. Unending adagios, but first and foremost, joy, wild joy of shape, the laughing sister of death. I'm very glad there was no canal in this. Ed mentioned Krakow, which is one of my, it's probably my most important city, and I'm moving back to Krakow this summer. So I read the poem which actually appeared in a new translation, in a new version, in a new and selected poems. So it's also translated by Claire Kavanagh. And it's called A View of Krakow. Before me, Krakow in a gray valley, swallows buried on long braids of air. Rooks in black cloaks look after it. Hungry bees buzz in the bird cherry bushes. What was, what is, are carefully divided. Kings in marble tombs, tombs in crypts, God in prayers, fingers in rings. Before me the church of St. Catherine never finished. Gothic arches trudge upwards, the shoulder blades of sleepy monks who have forgotten which word wakes the Lord. A low valley before me. A lonely old woman lived here and died not long ago of age or loneliness? Who will remember the kind of dough she baked, her angry eyes? Which nation claims her now? Who granted her asylum? Black poplars stand beside her, and a nightingale trapped in the leaves rehearses, as always, its pearly prophecy. Before me, Krakow, a grey valley. A girl runs late for her lecture through a dense tunnel of trees. Petals of peonies grow in her hair. Time's tenderness weaves a nest in her hair. She runs fast, but she doesn't move. She's always in the same spot, beneath the chestnuts, which cast off old greenery and put on new. Before me, gleaming grass, open penknives, starlings like scouts, the horizon, other cities, borders, balconies, thoughts, double meanings. The great bodies of churches sway slowly like captive balloons. Children run across the flagstones, trembling hoops, and the sun ahead of them, craving coolness, hides in the shade of sycamores. Chimneys send up thin smoke trails as if conclaves were always in session, and as even the apartment buildings longed to join in the game of existence. And I hear the song ever louder, growing in the courtyard's wolfish throats. Song of the forgotten, song of the wronged, the mute, the absent, the dead, the voices of those who passed quietly through life. I hear the rising music, racket, roar, prayer, lullaby. The song of drowning ships, the cries of the survivors. In the morning, orioles ask for water. In the evening, owls weep and jolted sweethearts fret in the local theater. And a wild song vibrates in so many larynxes. And the prisoner and the secret policeman nod off, as does the everlasting world borrowed from a great library. There's a river in Krakow, but apparently not mentioned. This poem is called A Talk with Friedrich Nietzsche. Most highly respected Professor Nietzsche, sometimes I seem to see you on a sanatorium terrace at dawn, with fog descending and song bursting the throats of the birds. Not tall, head like a bullet, you compose a new book and a strange energy hovers around you. Your thoughts parade like enormous armies. You know now that Anne Frank died, and her classmates and friends, boys, girls, and friends of her friends, and cousins, and friends of her cousins. What are words, I want to ask you? What is clarity? And why do words keep burning a century later, though the earth weighs so much? Clearly, nothing links enlightenment and the dark pain of cruelty. At least two kingdoms exist, if not more. But if there is no God and no force welds elements in repulsion, then what are words really? And from whence does their inner light come? And from where does joy come? And where does nothingness go? Where is forgiveness? Why do the incidental dreams vanish at dawn and the great ones keep growing? Maybe I read a poem in Polish and then the same poem in English. Probably nobody ever has read a poem in Polish in New Mexico before. So first in Polish and then in English, or maybe better the other way around. Yes, better the other way around. The English title is Poetry Searches for Radiance. Poetry searches for radiance. Poetry is the kingly road that leads us farthest. We seek radiance in a gray hour at noon, or in the chimneys of the dawn, even on a bus in November, while an old priest nods beside us. The waiter in a Chinese restaurant burst into tears, and no one can think why. Who knows, this may also be a quest, like that moment at the seashore when a predatory ship appeared on the horizon and stopped short, held still for a long while. And also moments of deep joy and countless moments of anxiety. Let me see, I ask. Let me persist, I say. A cold rain falls at night. In the streets and avenues of my city, quiet darkness is hard at work. Poetry searches for radiance. And now the same poem. It's of course a philosophical question whether it's the same poem. But let's say the same. It's again the translation. This is a new poem, so translated by Clerk Kavanagh. Poezja jest poszukiwaniem blasku. Poezja jest królewską drogą, która prowadzi nas najdalej. Szukamy blasku o szarej godzinie, w południe lub w kominach świtu. Nawet w autobusie w listopadzie, kiedy tuż obok drzemie stary ksiądz. Kelner w chińskiej restauracji wybucha płaczem i nikt się nie domyśla dlaczego. Kto wie, może i to jest poszukiwaniem. Podobnie jak chwila na brzegu morza, gdy na horyzoncie pojawił się drapieżny okręt i zatrzymał się, znieruchomiał na długo. A także momenty głębokiej radości i niezliczone momenty niepokoju. Pozwól mi zobaczyć, proszę. Pozwól mi wytrwać, mówię. Wieczorem pada zimny deszcz. W alejach i ulicach mojego miasta bezgłośnie i żarliwie pracuje ciemność. Poezja jest poszukiwaniem blasku. Maybe now a poem called Electric Elegy. There's a long list of dictators in this poem, so take it easy. It's the hero of this poem is a German radio, because this other city to which my family was deported after war was a kind of post-German, so where the Germans were deported to the West, and so it's a kind of unpleasant Central European business of deportation. Farewell, German radio, with your green eye and your bulky box, together almost composing a body and soul. Your lamps glowed with a pink, salmony light, like Bergson's deep self. Through the thick fabric of the speaker, my ear glued to you as to the lattice of a confessional, Mussolini once whispered. Hitler shouted. Stalin calmly explained. Bierut hissed. Gomulka held endlessly forth. But no one radio will accuse you of treason. No, your only sin was obedience. Absolute tender faithfulness to the kilohertz. Whoever came was welcomed. Whoever was sent was received. Of course I know only the songs of Schubert brought you the jade of true joy. To Chopin's waltzes your electric heart throbbed delicately and firmly and the clothes over the speaker pulsated like the breasts of amorous girls in old novels. Not with the news, though, especially not Radio Free Europe or the BBC. Then your eye would grow nervous, the green pupil widen and shrink as though its atropine dose had been altered. Mad seagulls lived inside you and Macbeth. At night, forlorn signals found shelter in your rooms. Sailors cried out for help. The young comet cried, losing her head. Your old age was announced by a cracked voice, then rattles, coughing, and finally blindness. Your eye faded and total silence. Sleep peacefully, German radio. Dream Schumann and don't waken when the next dictator rooster crows. This poem is called Dutch Painters. It's from Mysticism for Beginners. Pewter bowls heavy and swelling with metal, plump windows bulging from the light, the palpability of leaden clouds, gowns like quilts, moist oysters. These things are immortal but don't serve us. The clocks walk by themselves. The floor tiles are never bored and sometimes play chess with the moon. An ugly girl studies a letter written in invisible ink. Is it about love or money? The tablecloth smell of starch and morals. The surface and depths don't connect. Mystery? There is no mystery here, just blue sky, restless and hospitable, like a seagull's cry. A woman neatly peeling a red apple. Children dream of old age. Someone reads a book is read. Someone sleeps, becoming a warm object that breathes like an accordion. They liked dwelling. They dwelled everywhere, in a wooden chair back, in a milky streamlet narrow as the Bering Strait. Doors were wide open, the wind was friendly. Brooms rested after work well done. Homes bared all. The painting of a land without secret police. Only on the young Rembrandt's face an early shadow fell. Why? Tell us, Dutch painters, what will happen when the apple is peeled, when the silk dims, when all the colors grow cold. Tell us what darkness is. Refugees. Bent under burdens which sometimes can be seen and sometimes can't, they trudge through mud or desert sands, hunched, hungry, silent men in heavy jackets, dressed for all four seasons, old women with crumpled faces, clutching something, a child, the family lamp, the last loaf of bread. It could be Bosnia today, Poland in September 39, France 8 months later, Germany in 45, Somalia, Afghanistan, Egypt. There's always a wagon, or at least a wheelbarrow full of treasures, a quilt, a silver cup, the fading scent of home. A car out of gas, marooned in a ditch, a horse soon left behind, snow, a lot of snow, too much sun, too much rain, and always that special slouch, as if leaning toward another better planet with less ambitious generals, less snow, less wind, fewer cannons, less history. Alas, there is no such planet, just that slouch. This is a poem that Ed doesn't like, but I still have to read it. It's called Houston, 6 p.m., and it's about the... It's a little treatise on the time difference between Europe and the U.S. Well, before I was afraid I'm writing too much about canals. Now I see I write too much about Boston. Houston, 6 p.m., Europe already sleeps beneath a coarse plaid of borders and ancient hatreds, France nestled up to Germany, Bosnia in Serbia's arms, lonely Sicily in azure seas. It's early evening here, the lamp is lit, and the dark sun swiftly fades. I'm alone. I read a little, think a little, listen to a little music. I am where there is friendship, but no friends, where enchantment grows without magic, where the dead laugh. I am alone because Europe is sleeping. My love sleeps in a tall house on the outskirts of Paris. In Krakow and Paris, my friends wade in the same river of oblivion. I read and think. In one poem I found the phrase, there are blows so terrible, don't ask. I don't. A helicopter breaks the evening quiet. Poetry calls us to a higher life, but what's low is just as eloquent, more plangent than Indo-European, stronger than my books and records. There are no nightingales or blackbirds here with their sad, sweet cantilenas, only the mockingbird who imitates and mimics every living voice. Poetry summons us to life, to courage, in the face of the growing shadow. Can you gaze calmly at the earth like the perfect astronaut? Out of harmless indolence, the grease of books and the Jerusalem of memory, there suddenly appears the island of a poem, unpeopled. Some new cook will discover it one day. Europe is already sleeping. Night's animals, mournful and rapacious, move in for the kill. Soon America will be sleeping, too. That's supposed to be a sign, green, or when it's too late, it's red, but I see nothing. Since I guess time has stopped. This is one of these blessed moments when time stops. This is a poem called Apartment for Scholars, and it's kind of a sociological poem. When you are a poet, you it happens a lot that you are invited to fellowships or things like this. And poets always accept those because they are not businessmen, so they need fellowships. And you sometimes are put up in a strange apartment. And this is a description of one of those. The apartment for visiting scholars holds a bookshelf with a dozen weary novels in a language not spoken by your kin, a sleepy Buddha, a mute TV, a battered skillet bearing traces of Saturday night's dismal scrambled eggs, a drab teapot that whistles in every idiom. You try to settle in and even think. You read Meister Eckhart about distance, Abgeschiedenheit, the poems of a British Francophile, an Anglocentric Frenchman's prose. And only after several days of struggling to inhabit these hygienic quarters, hospice to the cream of cultivated humankind, you realize with something close to all that no one lives here. There is no life on earth. This one is called Separation, and it's one of the new poems in this new poems section. Separation. I read almost with envy my contemporaries' verse. Divorces, partings, wrenching separations, anguish, new beginnings, minor death, letters read and burned, burning, reading, fire, culture, anger, and despair. The very stuff of potent poems, stern verdicts, mocking laughter of the lofty moralists, then, finally, the triumph of the all-enduring self. And for us, no elegies, no sonnets about parting. A poem's screen won't rise between us. Apt metaphors can't sever us. The only separation that we don't escape is sleep, sleep's deep cave where we descend alone. And I must keep in mind that the hand I'm clasping then is made of dreams. Try to praise the mutilated world. Try to praise the mutilated world. Remember June's long days and wild strawberries, drops of wine, dew. The nettles that methodically overgrow the abandoned homesteads of exiles. You must praise the mutilated world. You watch the stylish yachts and ships. One of them had a long trip ahead of it, while salty oblivion awaited others. You've seen the refugees going nowhere. You've heard the executioners sing joyfully. You should praise the mutilated world. Remember the moments when we were together in a white room and the curtain fluttered. Return in thought to the concert where music flirted. You gathered acorns in the park in autumn and leaves added over the earth's scars. Praise the mutilated world and the gray feather a thrush lost and the gentle light that strays and vanishes and returns. Thank you.
That concludes the reading for this event. Up next is the conversation.
Thank you, Adam, for a wonderful reading. I'm just thinking, what would have happened if you had been born in Venice?
But I can swim.
How many canals would we have then?
But how lovely.
I love this little poem that you began with. I think it's a beautiful way to open a poetry reading. It's a kind of prayer. It seems to me that a poem in the form of a prayer, you ask for things that we don't have. Otherwise, we wouldn't call on God for it. And I'm struck that in this poem, you call for a quiet speech and a consoling music. But one thing I want to ask you about is, one thing you say is, and a little pride. So it strikes me that this must be something you feel we don't have.
Well, I can only speak for myself. As you know, it's very hard to comment on a, on one line. I think in this poem I ask for paradoxical thing. I ask for a long winter too. Someone would ask why long winter? Do you love winter? I think winter is the time of meditation. Is summer the time of action? And I think we have too much action, too little meditation nowadays. And I think we have too much irony, too little pride. So I'm not asking for irony because it comes just like this.
So you see pride as a kind of counter to irony?
Yeah, but also kind of... it's very hard to say. It kind of being... maybe not just irony, but just... I think if you write poetry, you want to do something that goes a little bit against the current of your time. Understand that poetry should be not so much dictated by the zeitgeist, but rather speaking against the zeitgeist. And I think the pride is not very high on the list of priorities of art.
Because I also thought of your wonderful poem, Farewell for Zbigniew Herbert. And if I remember, the end of the poem is your poem's majestic pride.
No, I marvel at your
kingly
poem's
pride.
Kingly pride.
Your poem's kingly pride. So this is quality he had. Your poem, Refugees, I think I may have been remembering it wrong because I remember it ending a little differently.
I just cut the ending. Just you know, reading a poem is like a pianist who plays and it's an interpretation. Sometimes I like this ending less.
I rebel against the reading tonight because I like this ending. What is it? So floating nowhere, floating on no one?
Something like that, but I think it's not very convincing.
You know, it happens. Older poets censor their younger selves.
Well, but next week, maybe I will read this. I mean, it's just this little element of improvisation. Is it a problem?
Just putting my vote in for the accurate ending.
I'll think about it.
I love these poems of yours about music. These were some, I mean, it brought two of the poems that you read tonight brought me back to my first thrilling experience of reading you by myself when I read Tremor and was so transported. And I love this poem, Late Beethoven, and the poem about Nietzsche. And these two poems struck me that these are not poems that an American poet could have written. I don't know exactly why. But in Late Beethoven, you have this wonderful line, and now that I know your work so much better, I see that it's sort of something that reverberates through all of your work. We don't know what music is. And music, it seems to me, so deeply part of your work, and the music that you listen to seems to inhabit your work, and I just wonder if you'd be willing to say something about your response to music and how it operates in your poetry a little.
Well, it's a difficult question, but not...
This is my job.
Well, for me, this poem, Late Beethoven, is... this. I wrote this poem in Krakow in an unpleasant political moment. When this is the moment of the martial law that was suspended over Poland. For me, it was a kind of political poem, and then this was the experience of music, and this was there's several months of curfew, and not, you know, martial law is not war, but still was not a civilized way of living, and I'm not saying that I discovered music only then, but suddenly, in a situation like this, music speaks even stronger to you. But I try to write a poem which would be at the same time political and music or on music. So I see music as as a kind of element, like next to water, earth, fire, and etc., etc. And I respond to music very strongly. Music is something that wakes me up from my moments of lethargy, and from this is the waking call. But finally, I don't know what music is. Because I think this. I think we know better what painting is than what music is. Painting is more definable.
It's concrete and it's visual. You can see it.
Yes, it's more defined by the craft also. And in music, there's something even more mysterious. So maybe music is the metaphor of the mystery of the world which remains for us. This is the mystery for which makes us write poems. Why would we write poems if there were no mystery?
I feel that it does somehow when music comes in your poems, we're sort of transported to a place of a kind of sense of awe before something great, a feeling of majesty before something we don't understand. And music is one of the ways that your poems get us there.
Yeah, psychologically speaking, this is what happens. Not every day, of course. Listening to music is sometimes gives you nothing. It comes back and forth. It returns. Yeah, but I there's this kind of trigger, I think, in music. There are some philosophical speculations on music, but we don't need these. I just think that I also feel a deep affinity between poetry and music. So, and also because there's also a kind of, not technical, but a formal interest, because I write basically in something which is free verse, but I don't like free verse. I would like to be... I don't like a kind of careless free verse. I try to make poems into not only meaningful entities, but also formally interesting. And music is my great master. So music is a kind of help, and also in the formal way of doing.
I think it's beautiful the way repetitions come back into your poems. And remember, the first thing I felt about late Beethoven was the note of we don't know who the immortal beloved is, and that keeps coming back as a kind of deep motif, as a kind of question. It's a sort of formal principle of the poem too.
Yeah, it's also a question. Someone told me once that there was a book where the author claimed that he discovered who the immortal beloved was. So I was mortified that the poem was gone. But I don't think it's really true, so I hope we still don't know.
I love a poem I didn't know till tonight that I heard you read. I thought was quite a wonderful poem, Poetry Searches for Radiance. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me this is a kind of ars poetica for you. It kind of speaks of something that so infuses your work of what poetry is for.
Well, I think I tried in this poem to contrast. It's very true that I'm looking for radiance, but I'm also afraid of losing touch with the earth and with the quotidian. So I, in this poem, I try to keep those two things near each other. I mean, the search for radiance or light. There's a translator's problem, but anyway. And that the other level is this trivial quotidian. This is the point where we differ. I know we had too many conversations, but.
That's not how I would have put it.
I mean, too many for our poor audience, in the sense that we exchange. No, I mean, Ed always says, well, you have to go as high as you can. I say, yes, but you have to keep your eye on the ground. So I try in my poems not to lose the sight of of the earth, of what's ugly. I'm always afraid of kind of aestheticizing in poetry, because I know I have this drive towards this higher realm, but I'm afraid of betraying the lower realm, because I always live between the two. It's impossible, at least before we die, it's impossible to inhabit only this higher realm. We always descend brutally into the lower one. And I feel I'm a kind of a reporter. I have to, for my readers, I'm a reporter. I have to render justice to my own journey, which is always back and forth between this, the trying to find something higher, and then returning to the darkness, to rain, to the ugliness of an industrial city, to my own imperfectnesses and all this.
Yeats has this great poem, Vacillation, and I feel that's what you're talking about, this mm-hmm. vacillation between the search mm-hmm. for something higher and the pull back to the earthly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one of the...
Yes.
This is a critique of the questioner. They're very tough here in Santa Fe. You see, if you don't ask questions that they like, they just start shouting. Okay, I'll translate this. He wants to know about the translation problem.
I know. There's a word in my language, in Polish, which is blask, and blask is not light. It's a kind of intense light, a kind of ecstatic light. And the first version, Claire Kavanagh proposed luster, but we think it's not the definite, because luster is more on the surface.
Yeah.
So I think the radiance is maybe better, because it's more, goes deeper.
I think that's right.
Uh-huh.
I feel that your poems translate very well, but then I read them in English. And then I hear you read it in Polish, and it feels like, well, maybe they don't translate so well, because of the element of sound.
Well, it seems that they translate well, but when I read them in Polish, the world of sounds is different, and of course, I'm afraid I read them better in Polish too, because it's my sound and the language of my childhood. But I think it's a something for something. I believe in a possibility of translation. And
I think Polish poetry that you know, you and I share a great love for many of your precursors in Polish poetry, and it seems to me that they also translate extremely well, in the sense that I'm thinking especially of Herbert, and I know that there must be a lot that's lost in translation, but he's such a great poet in English when you read him in English, because the refinement of the sensibility and the quality of the intelligence absolutely comes through. Do you have mm-hmm. some sense of this?
Oh, yes, I absolutely agree. But there are some major or even wonderful Polish poets that are untranslatable.
Białoszewski,
but also Iwaszkiewicz or Leśmian. That's the paradox, that you cannot know those who are untranslatable.
Yeah, yeah.
They may be translatable, but it's just a pitiful rendering of something that's much richer in original. But so those poets like Miloš Herbert or Anna Swier or Aleksander Vád and Szymborska.
Well, Szymborska translates very well, I think, because the pressure is all on the concepts. She seems to me a kind of conceptual poet, and the concepts are so smart and funny and thoughtful, but that concepts do translate in poetry, and so do images, but sound doesn't. Maybe some of her early poems don't translate so well, where there's more of a sound.
No, I think that you're absolutely right. It's a difficult situation, because I have to agree with you.
When I read about Zbigniew Herbert coming to your high school, this is like Shelley comes to your high school. This is amazing to me. So I wonder if you would tell everyone about this, your first experience with him.
Well, yeah, I was 17, and this was my last year in the high school, and there was this poet announced, and I have to say I didn't know his name. I was reading, I think this was my Kafka period, or my Proust period, and maybe when I was 16, 17, I read more translated literature. I was a little snob, so.
If you were an American pulpit, you'd be saying, it was my E.E. Cummings period.
Well, yes. And so he came and gave a reading. This was at noon, so there's the sense of relief that we, like, class was gone. But he impressed me very much. He read poems and a fragment of an essay, and he engaged in a conversation with us. And I this remained in my memory. And not, now, of course, I see it as a symbolic event, but this is what you do with your life. It's something that then I wanted to be a writer, but I think then still I thought, oh, I will be a novelist. So this was my early dream of being a Thomas Mann or somebody like this. But I was deeply impressed by him. And after this reading, I read his collections of poems and his essays. And then we became friends in Berlin, where we lived for several years, and in Paris.
In your poem to him, you meet in alien cities.
Yeah, we meet in alien cities, and one of the things I try to say in this elegy for Herbert, that we never know, we know someone who's a great poet, because I think he was a great poet. And he might be very witty and wonderful, or sometimes having problems, but we never actually see the person in poetic action. This hidden life of a poet. There's something so shameful, or at least very discreet, and a poet who's in the act of writing, of inspiration. You never see it. So these friendships are really not touching upon the deeper layer.
We never talked about when you first read Milos. Did you read him in Samizdat, or was it published when you were first encountering his poetry?
He was in a way completely absent from the bookstore, because he, as a political exile, for many decades he was completely absent. So I was a student, an undergraduate, and I had to ask my dean for a special permission. And I said, I invented some lies that I'm doing a paper on this, and I got this special permission, and only thanks to this special permission, I could go to the library, and they opened a special shelf, and I sat in a special reading room with professors, because this, otherwise I would be sitting with other undergrads. But I was directed to a professor.
And were these the sort of post-war poems? Is that what you first encountered?
Well, there's this book of then collected poems, which covered his whole poetic life. This was in the 60s, so this was this was in the middle of his writing life. But there was a book published in London, which you couldn't check out and take home, because you needed this special permission.
You know, I've always wanted to ask you about a poem of yours from Tremor, a poem called Fire, where you say, "Perhaps I'm just an ordinary middle class believer in individual rights." And when you wrote that poem, it must have been shocking to write it. I mean, I wonder if it felt shocking after your early sort of oppositional collective movement? I mean, did you write this poem, was it written in Paris?
No, it was written in Krakow much before I left.
And did it feel like you were being oppositional to your friends and to your early collective sensibility?
Well, I think nobody noticed, but but yeah, you're right. It was a kind of a mild dissident, and I enjoyed it a lot because this was great fun to be a dissident, and you met wonderful people, and it was also, you know, right. There was a moral and political truth in it, so not just fun. I wouldn't say it was just fun. But I just knew that this was not something that I was born to. I had my other life, which was mostly spent in solitude and in writing. So this was kind of a modest declaration of independence.
Well, I liked this when I first read it, this fire on one page, and then the next page, fire, mm-hmm. and then Pascal and Descartes. So I felt when I was reading it, well, I mean, I didn't know you, and I didn't know about your early history, but I just said, well, this is a kind of declaration against what must be the reigning idea of poetry just being in opposition to the regime, and that would be a great temptation or even a necessity. But I felt, well, now there's a declaration of belief in individual rights and also then the importance of philosophy and philosophical thinking.
Mm-hmm. Well, the Declaration of Individual Rights, I think, didn't go against the spirit of the mm-hmm. opposition. This opposition movement was very much democratic. But
there is a sense in the poem Fire of running with the crowd.
And this sense of that it's not my place.
That it's not your place, mm-hmm. and so there's sort of an independence of this.
Yeah, and even more in a fire poem. You're right, but I like to think of my poems as not having a kind of chasm in between the earlier period and the later one.
Maybe a turn.
Yeah, I believe in a kind of unity. And as I said, this Beethoven poem is for me also a political poem.
Yeah.
So what I would be afraid of is to tear away from this kind of writing that, as I hope, as I think, can unify an aesthetic experience or even a religious experience with a political experience.
Adam, we're running out of time, but I'm not giving up yet, because there's something that's important to say that I haven't gotten to yet. It seems to me that there's an important difference between Polish poetry and American poetry, and that something we've talked about often, and that there's an element of civitas in Polish poetry that seems different. And I wonder if you would just say something about your sense of that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's a sense of communality. It goes back to Romanticism. So it sometimes, when I was very young, I thought this was a kind of a curse. It's too much of the communal dimension. If you read Polish Romantic poets, they were wonderful poets, but some of them exaggerated in this dimension of the polis, of the civitas. And I think that maybe Miloš was the poet who discovered the right measure, of course, everyone has to find an individual measure for himself or herself. But I think the generation of Miloš discovered a measure that you can have both. You can keep your individual search, your feeling that you're very different from, and that you're an individual, both as a human being and as a writer, but you don't give up on this communal dimension. There's something even artistically interesting in having this communal. It's not just a kind of moral duty, but it's just so deeply interesting that we are a large part of our experience we can share with others. And this I, this lonely I, appears also, but not all the time. So I find it intellectually very interesting that you can combine your very solitary search with having this feeling that you're also maybe speaking for others.
I like this idea very much of a dialogue. It seems like there's a kind of dialogue that you have with Polish poetry and with the community, and that the Zimborska has a kind of dialogue and with it, and Herbert had a kind of dialogue with it, and Miłosz has had a 50-year, 60, 70-year dialogue with it. So, Adam, I feel sorry for the audience for one reason. I love this poem of your self-portrait, and I just wondered if maybe we could conclude by your presenting this poem. I think everyone would be lucky to hear it.
Okay. But we haven't made it up before. So.
Oh, come, stop pretending. I can't remember the canals in this poem. Now I see they've been left out.
Yes. You see how spontaneous it is?
Adam, could you try and read the whole thing instead of lopping off the...
In this case, the, yes.
I just have to point out one thing about the poem in advance. I just want to alert you to the fact that Adam thinks it's a great sign of loyalty in this poem that he sees his friends every other week.
Okay, was it a question?
It's observation.
Self-portrait. Between the computer, a pencil, and a typewriter, half my day passes. One day, it will be half a century. I live in strange cities and sometimes talk with strangers about matters strange to me. I listen to music a lot, Bach, Mahler, Chopin, Shostakovich. I see three elements in music, weakness, power, and pain. The fourth has no name. I read poets, living and dead, who teach me tenacity, faith, and pride. I try to understand the great philosophers, but usually catch just scraps of their precious thoughts. I like to take long walks on Paris streets and watch my fellow creatures quickened by envy, anger, desire, to trace a silver coin passing from hand to hand as it slowly loses its round shape. The emperor's profile is erased. Beside me, trees expressing nothing but a green, indifferent perfection. Black birds pace the fields, waiting patiently like Spanish widows. I'm no longer young, but someone else is always older. I like deep sleep when I cease to exist, and fast bike rides on country roads when poplars and houses dissolve like cumuli on sunny days. Sometimes in museums, the paintings speak to me and irony suddenly vanishes. I love gazing at my wife's face. Every Sunday I call my father. Every other week I meet with friends, thus proving my fidelity. My country freed itself from one evil. I wish another liberation would follow. Could I help in this? I don't know. I'm truly not a child of the ocean, as Antonio Machado wrote about himself, but a child of air, mint, and cello. And not all the ways of the high world cross paths with the life that, so far, belongs to me.
Listening to a Lannan podcast. You can subscribe to our podcasts at podcast.lannan.org. In addition, the Lannan Audio Archives present similar programs by national and international writers, poets, and social activists at www.lannan.org. Listen to hundreds of hours of recorded programs from the likes of Seamus Haney, Joy Harjo, Eduardo Galeano, Arundhati Roy, Jim Harrison, Edwidge Danticat, and Noam Chomsky. New programs are added every month to both the podcasts and the audio archives.